Hi everyone, I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. Our theme today, have we returned to the snake pits? My guest is Dr. Peter Bregan. Just a brief opening, and then we're going to turn it over to Dr. Bregan. And this is also a continuation of our series of conversations with remarkable minds, because Dr. Bregan is certainly, as you will see, a remarkable mind. And he's board certified in his field in psychiatry. He's worked for the National Institutes of Health earlier in his career, but he saw that what he was doing was not giving the patients the best possible treatment, nor were the treatments being administered, including electroconvulsive therapy or shock therapy, where you create a grand mal seizure in the brain, nor the many drugs. Remember now, we have an advertisement on television to help you overcome the side effects of tardive dyskinesia, which is a side effect of just one of the drugs that was taken commonly in the 1970s and after. So here's the story. There was a time in American history where people who did not fit in, and by the way, you could end up being considered mentally ill if you refused to abide by the common standards that people accepted. If you were argumentative, that was enough to get you in. And a lot of women were diagnosed as having an argumentative temperament, and therefore to prove that they weren't going to be argumentative to their husband, they would have their ovaries removed. We had all these very strange operations and strange procedures, and they were called insane asylums. They were also called snake pits, and the history of that is just abhorrent. Now, the question is all that in our past? Are we using drugs today that really help people, that are non-toxic and safe? Are we able to prevent suicidal ideation or suicide in the young people who are using it on a regular basis, suicide, or attempting? Or all the drugs? Why are so many young people taking drugs, especially during COVID? And some of these drugs can kill you. In fact, one of these drugs was found to have caused the opiates, over 100,000 deaths just last year. But all alcohol abuse also caused 100,000 deaths. So that's a lot of people to die, and yet you don't see a single thing being promoted by our Surgeon General, the U.S. Public Health Service, to prevent this. Why not? But they have an answer. The psychiatric community says, you're only going to do this if you have a brain chemical imbalance. Something's wrong in your brain. There's not enough or too much of serotonin or dopamine, but if you take a selective serotonin reuptake inhibiting drug, that will inhibit the reuptake of serotonin, which means you're going to be more emotionally normal. As a result, that's one of the most commonly prescribed and used drugs in America. Is it safe? Is it effective? What is the science proving it works? All of these are the issues that we're going to address with Dr. Bregan. Nice to have you with us today, Dr. Bregan.
Oh, it's so good to be here. You and I have such a long, wonderful history. I want people to know that the maker of this film, Gary Knoll, was standing up for my work stopping lobotomy in the 1970s. I do believe that Gary Knoll was the first person with his own radio show who ever let me come on it with any size audience to talk about the mutilation of brains that my colleagues were doing and my determination to put an end to it.
That was 1973 on WMCA, about 50 years ago. Dr. Bregan, I'm going to give you a series of overarching questions. Please address them in depth, if you will. Talk about what has happened to our so-called mental health as a society, and include in that your understanding of what we all face, no matter if we're the son or daughter of a billionaire, everything that could be possibly done in that cocoon they're raised in still doesn't guarantee they're going to be happy and successful with their own lives. We see people of all walks of life committing suicide or being addicted for getting psychiatric help. Next, why do you believe that we are not prepared, as previous generations were better prepared, including the Great Depression families, our greatest generation, of dealing with these emotional crises? Why? And how many college kids today are unprepared for critical thinking exercises in class? So therefore, they have to have special chambers where they go out and they go in there and they can be with teddy bears and have counseling because someone said something that they suddenly were tripped into some emotional spasm by. What does that mean when these people graduate and go into the larger society? How are they supposed to help us deal with crisis if they can't deal with their own emotional crisis? Are we seeing the emotional breakdown of an entire generation? And what does that portend for the future? More importantly, what has happened with the idea that we want to first do no harm in treating patients, diagnosing and treating? How accurate is the diagnosis of mental disorders in our society? What is the strength and weakness of the DMS-5, the Diagnostic and Statistical Bible of Psychiatry? And if you're in there, then you got a mental illness. What is the evidence? Where is the actual independent science? What role has the American Psychiatric Association or other organizations played in maintaining the myth that a new condition that someone makes up, like math defiance disorder, and where you just don't like math? Since when does that become a brain chemical imbalance disease? But it's in that Diagnostic Statistical Manual. What are the actual tolls of people being harmed or dying from using the current protocols? And why is that never discussed? In the last 20 years, 120,000 GIs committed suicide, most by simply putting a gun in the mouth and blowing their brains out. The vast majority of those people were on the SSRIs given to them in the VA and even in the battlefield. Yet we've had no discussion in our society about, is this the right way of treating these people who are suffering from some trauma? And what is the difference between a GI today and a GI in the Vietnam War, the Korean War, the World War II, World War I, the Civil War, the Revolutionary War? We've always had trauma, but now we've pathologized it so that what, people can make a profit from it? Please discuss these, and is anyone in the media paying attention, or have they, because of their advertising dollars, acted as useful fools when it comes to pretending there's no crisis when we have a major crisis? The forum is yours.
I think that one good way to frame for the folks watching this film an overview is to look at how I got involved in the psychiatric field, because my involvement was somewhat unique. I was only 18 years old. I was a volunteer at a giant state mental hospital, a true snake pit, in 1954. I went there with clear eyes. I had a lot of interest in psychology, but I did not think I would become a psychologist or a psychiatrist. And when I got to the hospital, along with a few other students, I was struck at the horror of it all, and how similar it was to my Uncle Dutch's descriptions of liberating a Nazi extermination camp. A giant facilities filled with people in barracks-like conditions, cement walls, no place to go during the day, bedrooms were locked, nothing to do, maybe a broken TV, wooden chairs that were too heavy for people to throw at each other. Nobody even watching over them as the volunteers as we'd go in. I discovered that some of these patients had been lobotomized and lobotomies were still going on, and they would be in this population of what was called the violent women's ward, which is the first ward I ever saw and one that I would return to again and again over several years. And these people were just dilapidated. They couldn't control their bladders. They were drooling. Everybody was on drugs. Most people, or many people at least, had electroshock treatment. And I went and I watched electroshock treatment. After I became the leader of the program, I went and I watched electroshock. And I could see that the patients were brought in, you know, either really angry or really depressed or having a lot of feeling. And then after the shock treatment, it was like seeing somebody after an auto accident. They were bludgeoned, confused, helpless, grateful if you took their hand and led them around because they were just completely confused. They were concussed severely. I saw patients given overdoses of insulin where they would lie literally on the verge of dying on the floor, writhing with convulsions often, and the aides would give them doses of sugar water or orange juice with sugar in it. They would come out of the insulin-induced coma, and they would no longer be like they were when they had come in, which was human, full of feeling, often very afraid of what was going to happen. And they would just be helpless, grateful, dependent people who, again, could be led off to the wards. So it's not like I had to figure things out from a textbook. I could see that this was wrong. I simply had not been given the training that blinds and corrupts your vision. I discovered that what people really needed was human conduct. Comfort. What people really needed was human comfort, human relationship. I developed a special program where we got 15 of our own patients. We each were assigned a patient. This was the leaders of the program, not the couple of hundred people we would take through from Harvard and Radcliffe. And the hospital was afraid we would hurt these people. I really had to use my influence as the leader of this big volunteer program to get them to give us a program, the leaders, where we would just have 15 patients of our own and we would be supervised once a week by a really lovely social worker. And instead of ruining them, we got almost all of them out of the hospital. So here was the contrast. On the one hand, you can care about people, you can engage them, you can help them, you can get them out of this horrible place, some to their families, some to much better homes. None of them in the snake pits anymore. And it was there. It was just present. Now I want to leap ahead, and I'll weave back and forth. At that time, if you went to a school for first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh grade, an elementary school, probably none of the children would be on psychiatric drugs. That's 1954, 55, 56, 57. I was there 54 to 58 in the hospitals. If you interviewed the Harvard students, maybe somebody would be taking some sort of a stimulant to stay up the night before an exam, but no one I ever talked to. Nobody was on drugs that I knew of. And I work with a lot of volunteers who probably would have talked to me as a volunteer leader about it. The drugging, the shocking, the lobotomizing was all limited to the hospital. Now, thanks to the work I did in the 70s, organizing an international campaign, there's very little lobotomy going on. But now, everything that used to be in the state mental hospitals has been shifted into the society, often at higher rates of drugging than you had in the hospitals. So when I would go on to the children's unit, which was separate, and might have had 50 kids in it, maybe 5, 6, 7 kids were on psychiatric drugs in the state mental hospital. And it's not like we didn't have drugs. I mean, we had plenty of drugs to give them. And now, if you go to an elementary school, you may have more numbers of that, depending on the school's orientation and the parents in the community. You may have more kids on in a normal kindergarten or junior, and certainly up in the junior high, than in the children's unit at Metropolitan State in 1954. So what has happened is that through the pressure of the drug companies to make markets, we've made a market out of the society, and particularly a market out of children. So now we may have 25% of women on antidepressants. We may have 30% of our children in one kind of drug or another, maybe 10% on the stimulants for so-called ADHD. But they'll be on antidepressants, some will be on antipsychotics. And to accomplish this, the drug companies have done something that sheds light on what went on in COVID-19, which I won't be talking about today, but which prepared me for COVID-19, which is that the drug companies would work with the university physicians, the big medical docs, the psychiatrists at Harvard or Yale or LA. They'd work with them to make markets, to get out of the state hospitals and into the population. So a man named Joseph Biederman was at Harvard, and he was the head of the Children's Psychopharmacology Division at the medical school at Harvard. So he was the recipient of huge amounts of money, which always happens in these situations, from the drug companies. And what he did was create a diagnosis, made it up himself, and it's still not accepted. That's probably just some failure of their manipulations, but still not accepted. He decided that a lot of children had childhood bipolar disorder, and the manifestations weren't the great highs and the great depressions of adults. No, they might just be angry and irritable and jumpy. In other words, anything unusual could be fit into childhood bipolar disorder. And within no time, there were hundreds of thousands of children in America diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And he was getting tons of money for Harvard. We don't know how much for himself. Some indications, I've researched him at the time, and we did find some money that was definitely from the drug companies. And then later, a Senate committee following up on my research got him to admit about the millions of dollars he was getting. And he was particularly getting money from Johnson & Johnson. And it was a division of Johnson & Johnson that was making a horrible antipsychotic drug for adults called Risperdal. It was not approved for children for anything at the time. And when you looked at the data, there were more children with a diagnosis of bipolar on heavy, destructive psychiatric drugs than there were adults in the regular population labeled bipolar on these drugs. So actually the majority of people with that label were not getting heavily drugged, whereas the majority of children were. So it's marketing, it's power, and it's control. Now, it was known very early on that these drugs were neurotoxins. I was starting in the hospitals in 1954 when these drugs started to come in. And in 1953, it was discovered that a drug called chlorpromazine, if you gave it to surgical patients, they might have the usual pain, but they didn't care and they didn't complain. They didn't bother the doctors and the nurses. So that surgeon knew a couple of psychiatrists named DeLay and Dendiker, and he said, you should try these on your patients. So they did. They just gave the whole ward of patients these drugs, this drug, Thorazine, and the nurses on the first day were just delighted. It was just so much easier to work on the ward. People weren't making demands. Everybody was standing in line dutifully for dinner, for their pills. And they said they knew on the basis of those nurses' responses that they had a miracle drug. Then gradually, the women, and it was mostly the women's wards, the women were developing weird grimaces and torsions of their neck, horribly painful things. They were getting enormously jittery with something called akathisia, the inability to sit still, which is literally being tortured from the inside out. When you feel the akathisia, you are so anguished in your body that all you can do is pace and walk around or move your hands or pull your hair or do something with your body to distract yourself from how terrible you felt from these drugs. Now, they just gave these drugs out and they said this was a women's disease of old age. This is what they do in medicine and psychiatry. And they're doing it today through the public health people and all the drugs. They ignore the horrors they're creating because it's giving them enormous wealth and power. And the doctors, and I'm a physician, through their training have become indoctrinated to follow authority and to follow the drug company influence. So back in 1954, when they first gave their drugs, they could see the bad things it was doing to people, but they ignored them and blamed them on the mental illness. Then they gave the drugs to a bunch of young soldiers. And the soldiers were on the drugs long enough, it only takes a few weeks, to start getting the same twitches and torments. So they now knew that this was a disease they were creating. So what did they do, these evil people? They went to the drug company and they said, this thorazine, chlorpromazine, boy, it's really great. It's a neurotoxin. What's the worst, what's the strongest one you got? Which are the monkey? What drugs are making the monkeys twitch the most? And they said, Haldol, haloperidol. And that then became the standard drug more and more. To this day, you can still be given thorazine and Haldol in an emergency room, on a psych ward, or by your practitioner. And Haldol is frequently used in emergency rooms because you jab the person with it and they become docile. They become compliant. Now, I didn't want in those days to think outside the box so far. I mean, it was enough that I'm taking on the drug companies and all, to think that this is part of a worldwide process to make more docile populations, shock treatment, lobotomy. Because all the psychiatric treatments, because psychiatrists don't do psychotherapy. That was a very brief period of time when they were doing psychotherapy, and that was never more than 10% of psychiatrists were ever doing psychotherapy. They're always doing the drug shock and lobotomy. And as I researched and began publishing medical books, I had the blessing of having a medical publisher behind me and doing popular books and scientific articles. It became obvious to me that all these treatments could do was disable the brain. And if you wanted it to be disabled as a person, just like when you drink a lot or smoke a lot of dope and get numb and lose some of your feeling, you can even do it, smoking a lot of cigarettes, that it was all the same, that it all was brain disability. And some people would want some of the brain disability, but rarely did they want the antipsychotic drugs because of all the horrible feelings they would get from them. And that there was no treatment for the things they were treating, that what they were calling mental illness was either ordinary human strife and conflict, or maybe more extreme human strife and deprivation and conflict, often going back to childhoods that were abusive or neglectful, often going back to urban conditions and poverty, because in the state mental hospitals, the most common, the defining variable, interestingly enough, was not even racism. The defining variable was poverty, which included many African Americans, but the major group were older women who were in poverty or who were abandoned by their husbands and, for just being too difficult or too time consuming or too expensive. You could literally, as a psychiatrist, call a hospital and say, I have a 70-year-old woman or a 55-year-old woman who's having a lot of trouble. Do you have an opening? And they always had openings. They just filled themselves up. So we have an institution built on power, built on involuntary treatment, the power to lock people up, like I was just describing, on the say-so in those days of one doctor, now it might take two in some places, and then you might have to later go through a court hearing. But enormous power with drugs that essentially, eventually all do the same thing, including the stimulants, they subdue people. For example, if you take the stimulant amphetamine and you give it to children under the trade name Adderall, it's plain old amphetamine. It is only difference from cocaine is that cocaine is shorter acting and harder hitting. It's exactly the same drug class. If it's Ritalin, it's methylphenidate. That is also in the exact same drug class. It'll be in the same chapter in any psychiatry textbook that has about drugs or any pharmacology textbook. They're all in the same group. Now, what happens when you give a stimulant to a free-ranging monkey in the same dose range you give it to a child? The monkey loses its social concerns, its social interest, stops relating, then it's not as playful, it's not interested in the dominance hierarchy, it's not interested in the social life, it doesn't hug, it doesn't kiss anymore, monkeys do all these very human things, it doesn't groom other monkeys. It sits in its cage like a good, if it's in a cage, now it's ideal for a cage now. And you can put it in the cage and it'll sit there and it won't try to escape. It'll do OCD things, obsessive compulsive things, chew on bars, play with pebbles. And this is what we do to the children. We make them good cage children, whether they're at home or whether they're in school. And we do it by knocking out, by hitting multiple neurotransmitters in the brain, including those to the frontal lobe, the center of our human activity, gives us this big frontal area that no other animal has. And we are containing them. So in one way or another, this is what all the drugs do. The tranquilizers like Ativan and Xanax, which are two of the most addictive and most hard-hitting, are what my colleagues always do. The worst are used the most. And, well, that's like drinking alcohol without quite developing the same drunken state before you're getting real sleepy. But then eventually it's exactly like alcohol and you're staggering around and you're drunk and you fall down. And in fact, you can do anesthesia with them. And in fact, their major anesthesias are made from the same benzodiazepine compound. And you may call, you know, these drugs are called benzos for that reason. So going back again to revisit the beginning theme, what I saw coming and I began talking about, you know, probably in the 90s, late 80s, is that we were now emptying the mental hospitals in part by putting people on the streets. We didn't do it because the drugs were great or anything like that. We did it, the hospitals were emptied because as cheap as they were, there were so many people in them, the states couldn't afford them. So Social Security was changed so that it would cover mental illness, social disability. SSI would cover mental. So then they could just send people out with a check and they could find their own way on the streets or find their own way into nursing homes. That was part of it. But the biggest deal was you could drug them and they'd be docile. So they'd be more or less docile on the streets, although if they went into withdrawal off the drugs or to rebound from the drugs, they could get very agitated. We began to turn our country into a mental hospital. In California now, we have addicts living on the streets and getting drugs given to them, but we also have mental patients living on the streets, people who are very disturbed, homeless, having great personal inadequacy. They're not different than you or me. They just had it harder or made bigger mistakes or had worse luck, but they're not fundamentally different from you or me at all. I found that out in the state mental hospital. working there for all those years. I never met anybody who struck me as an alien. That wasn't just a human like me with harder, much harder times and probably a much worse start. So we're turning our nation in multiple ways into a pharmaceutical market and a mental hospital and a place to exploit people by buying. Now the states buy these drugs and the counties buy these drugs and the opiates, they give them to the people, or they give psychiatric drugs, usually these terrible antipsychotic drugs. Now, recently, you may have seen ads on the television. And the ad is for tardive dyskinesia, or TD, and they tell you that if you have a movement disorder from your psychiatric medication, which is usually going to be something like Seroquel or Abilify or Zyprexa or Risperdal or Invega, and drugs that may be given to you under the guise of antidepressants, like Abilify is, or under the guise of a sleeping pill like Seroquel is. So these ads show these happy people getting their tardive dyskinesia drugs. This is a travesty beyond explanation. I guess you have to have lived through seeing so many of these people as I have. There is one way only to partially relieve these awful twitches, and that's to get the person off the drug as quick as possible. As quick as possible. Now instead, we've given doctors a drug which they give to the patient instead of taking them off. So the pharmaceutical industry gets double now. It gets that same old neurotoxic, horrible drug, these antipsychotic drugs, or neuroleptics they're also called, and now a really new and expensive drug, which is virtually useless. These drugs don't work. They can actually make the tardive dyskinesia worse. They have a very poor record. For years and years and years, the only place you could find them was outside the U.S. But the U.S. now is becoming like a third world FDA. So we can have drugs that wouldn't have been put on the market 20 years ago or 30 years ago, put on the market. They're not new, these drugs. So my colleagues, after at first denying that anybody got these twitches and tremors, then said only old ladies got these twitches and tremors, then only old people got them, and then not children got them. I had to do a section of a medical book and get on TV, big national TV, telling people no, children get these too. So now they finally accepted after dozens and dozens of years that people actually get these things. So instead of doing what the good rare authorities did say for years, which is don't start on these drugs unless you must, and of course there's no ever you must, but you know, don't start on these drugs unless you must, and then if you see any problems, get off right away and be very careful with old people, because the rates in old people 20 to 30% per year get this. I mean, this is unbelievable. 20 to 30% a year, controlled clinical trials among the older people. Healthy younger people, 5 to 8% a year are getting tardive dyskinesia. Huge numbers. This is an epidemic. And in fact, the founders said we could cause an epidemic of neurologic disease with these drugs. And instead of stopping them, which was always the most important thing, now the doctor can feel safe. He can keep them on the one drug and start them on the other. This is how evil and corrupt the pharmaceutical industry is, and how corrupt all of medicine has become with the pharmaceutical industry, and ultimately with vast global powers behind all of this.
Dr. Bregan, that was very insightful. Thank you. Recently, there was a remarkable story that came out and was published in the scientific literature. It was a worldwide survey of all of the studies that were carefully examined when it makes the claim selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors is important when you're using it on people, for example, with depression. This study said no. You do not have the science on your side to be making these claims. That means that virtually all of science in psychiatry, all of public health, all the people taking these antidepressants have been taking them under a false premise. And it's time that the record were set straight and these toxic treatments were challenged. Could you give us the background on that, please?
Well, very recently, a woman whom I've known for many decades, Johanna Moncrief, she's a psychiatrist in Great Britain, did a giant review of the literature on a somewhat esoteric, somewhat unusual subject. Is depression caused by abnormalities in a substance in the brain, a neurotransmitter called serotonin? It was thought that excess serotonin was good for you, and people who were depressed weren't getting enough. And the drug was said to increase the availability of serotonin in the brain. Well, I'm probably the world specialist in this new subject because in 1994, I was asked to be the scientific researcher for all the combined lawsuits against Eli Lilly, the manufacturer of Prozac, who created this myth that depressed people had something the matter in their serotonin neurotransmitter. Now, my expertise that was mainly being looked at was the fact that that the drugs were causing violence, suicide, psychosis, mania, very extreme behaviors. And there were about 150 suits, and I was literally the one looking at the internal records of the drug company to testify about it in court. It immediately became obvious to me what Johanna has finally gotten some attention on many, many years later. It's apparent to me in 1994 that there was no evidence, number one, that serotonin caused depression. It was the great marketing tool, probably maybe the greatest ever, and it would inspire a whole line, starting with Prozac, now including Zoloft and Paxil and Celexa and a whole bunch of other so-called SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. All of them basically fighting the so-called abnormalities in the serotonin system. In fact, I was saying way back then that there are no abnormalities in the brain of anyone who's labeled mentally ill until they get their psychiatric drugs, which immediately create the biochemical imbalances. You see the big lie? The big lie has never been bigger than now with the psych drugs. So the drugs are causing biochemical imbalances, but there are none there. And in fact, and this surprises people, you can't even put a drug through the FDA in psychiatry for approval unless you first show how it's damaging the brain. They'll say how it affects neurotransmitters in an animal, but you're damaging the neurotransmitters in the brain. And what happened with Prozac is they jumped on some very poor studies which were never fulfilled, and they created a drug that would block the removal of serotonin from its normal places where it's supposed to be removed, from the synapses, which are the connections between the neurons. So the neuron, one neuron puts out a certain amount of serotonin into what's called the synapse or synaptic cleft. That is a spark that fires the next neuron and you get neurotransmission. That's a normal process. But Prozac and all these other drugs goes in there and stops the removal of serotonin from the synapse. In other words, it creates a vast abnormality. And then the brain starts fighting this because the brain doesn't lie down and, you know, die. It fights when it's drugged. And just like alcohol fights, and when you stop alcohol, you have the DTs because your brain's all revved up. Well, all psychoactive drugs produce reactions against them. All of them we know of in psychiatry. It's a process of self-defense. And the brain goes through elaborate lifelong changes to fight off the drug. And long-term, this leads to what I was describing to you earlier. It leads to the loss of emotional vitality. In these particular drugs, to the loss of sexual vitality. And I've taken many, many people off these drugs, gradually, safely. I've written a medical book called Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal. But I also have a chapter in a book called Medication Madness about drug withdrawal. It has to be done carefully, with knowledge, with some decent supervision if possible, reading, getting my whole textbook, medical textbook, but it's readable. Psychiatric drug withdrawal or getting medication madness will give you a start on that. You have to respect that the brain has been injured by the exposure. And you will find as you come off these drugs that you have more feeling. And you might need psychotherapy. So I do psychotherapy with the people I take off their drugs. By psychotherapy, I mean I have really good conversations with them about handling life, handling their emotions. Good conversations. And hopefully inspiring conversations. And so as you come off the drugs, you will go back toward normal, but it could go excessively. You could get depressed. You could get very anxious. Not because you need the drug. And this is where the big lie has been extended. Oh, look at you. I took you off all your Prozac and in 1 week you're getting mentally ill again. No. In 1 week you're starting to get in withdrawal. With some of the drugs it'd be 1 day. And it's not your mental illness coming back in a week. Believe me, it's drug withdrawal. And then they put you back on. So it's interesting that I worked so hard and published so many books about, and scientific articles, gave so many talks, but the drug companies eventually just canceled it. They have so much more power than I did as a single voice in psychiatry fighting these issues. There were some other folks, but very few of them had medical degrees. And Johannes thought of this really good idea, which is to review the literature, and she has shown that that it's a myth, that serotonin's got nothing to do with being depressed or not. Now, there's another whole side to this, which she did not investigate, which I investigated when I went inside of Eli Lilly, and I wrote about it in a huge bestseller that my wife and I wrote called Talking Back to Prozac. We wrote about this. And that's still available. What I discovered was that Prozac didn't work in its clinical trials for the FDA either. It didn't work. One reason was it caused so much overstimulation and insomnia that people were dropping out. So you couldn't even carry out a study long enough to make it statistically valid. So let's say you were going for an average of 6 weeks, which I think was their aim. Very short, folks. They just tested it for 6 weeks, very short. But they couldn't get past 3.5 or 4 weeks. So they broke the rules of the FDA without telling them, I believe, without telling them. And they gave the patients addictive sedatives like Xanax, I was just talking about, or Klonopin, or other sedatives to calm them down. And then when it came to approve the drug, none of the studies where the patients weren't sedated worked. The drug didn't work, or they didn't get enough people to stay in the study. So the FDA went against its most dearly held principles of stick to the rules in the tests, and it approved Prozac narrowly. I mean, it barely worked. It was probably all placebo, in fact. Probably all placebo. And they approved Prozac, and the world did not know that they approved it in combination with the sedative drugs. Doctors, incidentally, caught on real fast. They could see their patients getting jumpy and agitated often. And they started giving, eventually, these addictive substances. And some doctors now, if you start you on an SSRI, they're going to give you a sedative. So the smoke, the mirrors, the corruption was just profound that I was stepping into. And these drugs never worked from the beginning. When they do have an effect that people appreciate, it's either a temporary high, because the drugs can make you manic. Many mental hospitalizations, many, occur from mania and psychosis from these antidepressants.
Peter, I need you to give me, if you would please, some short answers on this.
Sure.
Okay, challenge the DMS-5. Because that's the Bible of psychiatry. And then also your input on, do you consider ADHD or ADD legitimate mental disorders? And as many children as being diagnosed and treated, is it overdiagnosed, overtreated, or properly diagnosed and treated?
One of the biggest scams of all is the diagnostic manual of the American Psychiatric Association. Many people compare it to an ancient book that was used to diagnose witches, because it really doesn't have any science behind it and is very prejudicial to the people who get diagnosed. Earlier days, the DSM-4 had a psychological influence in it, and you could... There were diagnoses like reactive neurosis, which meant you'd been under stress and you were feeling stress and so on and so forth. And there were many diagnoses that went in that direction. But once psychiatry became the handmaiden of the drug industry, every diagnosis was oriented to being biologic and claiming to be treatable by a psychiatric drug. So the Bible of psychiatry was transformed spiritually. The spirit was taken out of it. And it is now nothing more than something you can actually put into a doctor's phone or his special little drug device. And he pops a few things into it to give you a diagnosis, and out comes a drug. It's that simple now. And your GP who's not using a lot of drugs, that's what he'll do. Your psychiatrist, he can pop it out of his own brain. But what he's popping out is just a few words that you've said that meet with the diagnosis, and he's made up his mind or her mind within 2 or 3 minutes. So it's a big fraud, but it's a huge generator of money.
Do you consider, as done today, the field of psychiatry as a legitimate mental health service and science, or do you believe it's pseudoscience?
Psychiatry has always been pseudoscience. Its entire history is pseudoscience, full of prejudices, full of power. When psychiatry was unleashed on the world, it created the state mental hospital system, which at the time Nazi Germany came about, was killing as many of its patients practically as an extermination camp. The conditions were so bad, and then they turned them into extermination camps. Psychiatry is a very dangerous institution. It is harming the brains of tens of millions of children, a good portion of our child population. It kills outright the elderly and the aged with these antipsychotic drugs and gives them worse dementia. And instead of helping people with their sadness over divorce or their remembrances of child abuse or their frustration and anger, it drugs them into a state from which they will never escape in a creative fashion by dulling them. Psychiatry as we know it is an oppressive institution. It actually needs to be abolished. We can't have medicine faking knowledge and drugging, shocking, and lobotomizing people. We do need a profession of psychotherapy, but it is very hard to build, very hard to judge who's a good psychotherapist. It is going to be very hard for professionals and medical people to solve humanity's problems, which has to be solved by better treatment of children, better treatment of women, better understanding of love, more democracy and freedom. These are the things that really improve the lives of people.
Dr. Peter Bregan, thank you very much for being with us on the Progressive Commentary Hour. I appreciate it. I'm sure many people in the audience do as well. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening and watching, and have a nice day.
Mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother,